You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Michael LoMonaco came on this show just a little over a month ago to kick off our Food in the City series, we invited listeners to send in their favorite adapted recipes, and you sure did. 80 of you, all told. So, as promised, Michael read through them all, and he has picked the winners. He likes so many, in fact, that we have two sets of runners-up, and we will be talking with all of them during this segment. I'm sure you know, of course, that Michael LoMonaco is the executive chef and partner at Porterhouse New York at 10 Columbus Circle, the Time Warner Building, and I'm very pleased that he could return for this last of in our Food in the City segment. I'm sorry to see this segment end.
This was a lot of fun. Thank you, Leonard, for having me again.
How many of the 80 that were sent in were serious contenders?
Well, that's actually that's not an easy question because they were all serious contenders. They each had their and really truly each recipe had its own point of view, and some were better written than others, and some were easier to understand. But at the end of the, I think at the end, after really going through this quite a number of times and trying to understand it, there were out of 80, there were clearly 22 recipes that were really outstanding.
And what are you looking for when you decide what is an outstanding recipe or not?
Well, the parameters of the of the contest being sort of loose in a New York kind of way, I think that what I was looking for was something that was that made me hungry, that when I read it, I wanted to eat it. I wanted to cook it, really, and as I do love to cook in my own home in my own spare time, it was the kind of a recipe that I would want to do that. Well, also was not even would not be too overwhelming in the amount of preparation and time it takes. So there's a sort of a general sense of something that was simple, direct, and sounded delicious.
Do you have certain recipes that you make that were someone else's that? Where you followed the recipe exactly for a while and then at a certain point said, gee, what if I do this or do that, will I improve it?
Well, I've learned a lot of recipes from other people, and not just as a professional chef, but as a home cook, as a hobbyist. I mean, it's cooking has been my hobby for as long as I could remember.
Because you went to college to study something totally different.
You didn't, sure.
You were going to be an actor?
Exactly. I went to Brooklyn College in the 70s as a speech and theater major. And, I was cooking then as an outlet, as a hobby, as a creative outlet, and also just like today, a way to experiment with food on a very limited budget.
So what gets you thinking about how to change something? Is it sense a taste that might improve something?
I think most people change recipes to simplify them for their own, to kind of meet their skill set or, what they have on hand.
That's usually my case.
Yeah, exactly. And with food, with savories or things that, desserts and baking are more exacting. And ingredient selection, technique, even the weather can affect a baking recipe. So that's more difficult to make changes to. But I think people, once they tap into the skill set of cooking, can get very creative with food. And I think it's one of the few things that people can do from a creative outlook that they can acquire the skill more easily than learning how to water paint, or do something, paint, or even photography is more difficult in so many ways than learning how to cook simple dishes, execute them well.
Benjamin Walker and Andrea Salenzi from our culture department went to your restaurant to film you making your adaptation of a recipe of brisket Texas style. And listeners can watch that on our website at WNYC.org. Now, it's an adaptation because you made it in an oven rather than a barbecue pit?
Exactly. And the end result is if you're from Austin, Texas, you would say is vastly different than a great barbecue beef. And that's true. But what I was looking for was a depth of flavor and texture. And in that barbecue beef recipe that you just referred to, I achieved a depth of flavor with the seasoning, with the dry rub and the slow cooking, and also a texture that was different from a boiled brisket.
So would a person who is used to eating that kind of brisket be fooled?
I prefer to think that they would be pleasantly surprised, and it would bring them. You know, I'm not sure about the video piece that you're referring to, but at one point, I was at Yankee Stadium at one of the restaurants as a guest chef, which was fun because it was my first time to Yankee Stadium this year. And as a guest chef, I brought that dish. And somebody walked up to me at the end of the meal and said, "I'm from Austin, Texas, and that's as good as barbecue gets." And I wasn't going to pop that balloon. I mean, I was happy they liked it.
You were going to tell me you did it in an oven. Well, I've looked at the video, and you marinated, 124 pounds of brisket for 3 days, put a rub on it, and then cooked it for 5 hours or 6 hours?
At between 5 and 6 hours, I started to take the smallest ones out of the oven. You know, the whole thing about the Texas brisket, I was doing a story for a television program I was doing at the time, and I spent a couple of days with real, authentic Austin barbecuers. You know, this is how they made their livelihood. And we looked at the beef they selected and, you know, what the fat layer and you just sort of how big they were. And we went through the whole, you know, the whole process, and they kind of shared their secrets with me. But I couldn't do that when I came home without building a pit barbecue. But the spice rub and that we use, and the 3 days of marinating in the refrigerator, and then the dry, slow roasting with only the barest amount of liquid to keep it from burning.
Now, can we talk about marinating for just a moment? I do want to get to our contest winners, but if you marinate, you're only really affecting the outside layer of cells, aren't you? You don't want it to go. People have actually shot marinade inside meat with a hypodermic needle, and it creates a kind of a mushy meat, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, that outside crust, you know, even when you smoke salmon, you let the air dry the outside of the fish even before you smoke it to enable, you know, a textural the texture of the fish to achieve so it's not a mushy smoked fish. And so too with the beef. You know, that 3 days of marination with the dry rubs, the dry rub that I use, is so deeply flavorful on the crust that it's enough. And I don't want to inject it into the soul of the meat, but I want that then to help. You know, it sort of all comes together at the surface, and I think that's when it's in the palate where all the flavors truly come together.
My guest is Michael LaMonaco, executive chef and partner at Porterhouse New York at 10 Columbus Circle. And we are going to be talking to some of the winners of our contest. In fact, let's go to Robert, who is tied for second runner-up with his nice Jewish Boys Italian Meatballs and Gravy Made with Love recipe. Hi, Robert. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Now, Michael, what attracted you to Robert's recipe?
What attracted me was, Robert, thank you so much for sending in the recipe. I just wanted to say that and I'm trying to just pull out that recipe to look at it, but what I remembered about the recipe that he set us up with, you know, this is the nice Jewish Boys Italian Meatballs and Gravy, and
I'm not even sure what that means. Yeah. I'm sure you're a nice Jewish boy, Robert, but why is that relevant to making Italian meatballs?
Well, you know, my nice Jewish mother had taught me this recipe really kind of under duress. I had asked her, she would never let me cook in her kitchen. She wouldn't let me come in her kitchen because I'm a nice Jewish boy and I'm not supposed to know how to cook. And so when I went to college and I realized I didn't know how to cook an egg, and I had an apartment and had to cook for myself, I asked her to teach me the recipe. She did, although left out a lot of detail. And it took many years and marrying an Italian girl to really learn how to turn this into a proper recipe.
Now, you say that the ingredients may be important, but the order is even more so.
Yes. Yeah, I as I've learned to make this and make it relatively quickly, putting the order I put the ingredients together became very important. My mother had never bothered to tell me when she said, you need to put some breadcrumbs in some meat and you need to use an egg, that you needed to put the egg and the breadcrumbs first together, make a kind of a mush, and then that's what gets mixed in with the meat. That little detail had escaped me until, well, maybe 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. One of the ingredients is an eighth of a cup of seltzer. Now, is that because this is a carbonara? Oh, that's a bad joke.
But, you know, that is actually some of the ingredients are what attracted me the most, because I thought it was in the spirit of the contest that it was an adapted recipe, but yet it still retained, you know, sort of the spirit of what the original meatballs were about. And, you know, Robert has beef, and he parenthetically says pork and or veal, but I think he's talking about beef and veal and turkey, and that's a pretty current kind of thing. Thinking of how people are also eat today, you know, they're lightening and maybe leaving out pork and putting in turkey. But the seltzer really got me. I said, because I wanted to know, like, what did that little amount do? But it must do something, change the breadcrumbs in the process.
What does it do?
Well, the reality was that the seltzer came from another recipe from my aunt for matzo balls. And I threw it into the meatballs one day because I typically, as I'm making that mixture of breadcrumbs and eggs and spices, I usually go too far with the breadcrumbs, which is intentional. I take it to where it's too thick, and then I start loosening it up with liquid. And I would use water, and then sometimes I would use, if I was using a lot of turkey, I would use olive oil. And then one day I said, let me try see how the seltzer works. And the seltzer might not have had much of an effect, but it seemed to lighten up the meatballs a little bit and lighten up the mixture a little bit.
And that's what you admire, people thinking that way.
Exactly. And that was sort of the most fun about this recipe. And I said I could see reading the recipe is not the same as cooking, but I think reading a recipe can tell you, does this sound good? Does this sound tasty? And this one did.
Thank you so much for talking with us, Robert. We're going to turn the tables now with Patricia. She has a special rogalach recipe that all of her Jewish friends' mothers ask for. Do they know that you're Sicilian?
They know I'm Italian. I don't think they differentiate.
So how did you wind up making rogalach? I mean, it's easier for me to understand how a Jewish kid could make Italian meatballs, because they're so much a part of our culture. But rogalach are a special, if wonderful, dessert, one of the greatest
yes.
desserts of all time, but really difficult to make.
Low. Yes.
It's funny. You make them sound so terrific. I think they are, but to me, they're one of the easiest things in the world to make. I started because of a friend who was Hungarian, and they have some kind of a similar pastry, and they put apricot in it. But then I met my husband, who's also not Jewish, and his mother used to make rugala in the horn shape.
Uh-huh.
He also worked in a kosher deli. So he would bring home frozen rugala that I would bake, and, you know, they were wonderful. So I saw a recipe in the newspaper, and I said, I could make these. I have a food processor. And it just started to happen. But I've gotten, I think, so much better at it because I keep my hands off it as much as possible, which keeps them very light. These are much more pastry-like than cookie-like or cake-like because the butter kind of melts. It just
So they get flaky.
I just made like about 200 of them the other day.
You know, in reading the recipe, what I liked about it seemed it seemed as though she was telling me the recipe was well written, but it wasn't written so so structured, in such a structured manner. It was as though, as just the way she's talking to us right now, as though she was telling me exactly how to make this. And there were enough adaptations in it. You can add chopped walnuts, you can add almonds, you could add chocolate, you know, that she sort of enabled you enabled me to want to be creative with this. And I think that's a great way to pass on a recipe to somebody.
Have you ever made Rogalach, Michael?
I have not. But, you know, it's one of those things that I drive around the five boroughs looking for the best one. And, you know, I always wind up back in my home borough, Brooklyn.
Yeah, well, there's a baker, Margaret Palka, who makes really great Rogalach. But it's rare these days. Yours looks like it would be the kind of thing that I grew up with. When I was a kid, they were smaller and more buttery than most of what you find in commercial bakeries today. And the ones today do taste more like cookies than that kind of flaky thing that makes Rogalach a special kind of a dessert.
The trick I have found is freezing the butter, because I freeze the sticks and then I cut them across both ways and then cut them down almost in tablespoons. So now what happens is, because the butter's frozen, it fractures. And when I throw it in the food processor, I'm not grinding it to so I don't see pieces of butter. I want to see clumps of butter in the dough. In fact, it's wrong if when you roll it out, you don't see pieces of it. Because when that, you know, typical of all pastry, when it melts, that's where you get the layers.
Well, that was very well done.
And thank you so much for speaking with us. And congratulations.
I'm honored.
Thanks, Patricia.
And we will be back with more of the winners and Michael Amonico, who is the executive chef and partner at Porterhouse New York in the Time Warner Building, 10 Columbus Circle. We're back with Michael Amonico, who is making his second visit to this show as part of a Food in the City series. Michael is the executive chef and partner in Porterhouse New York. Previously, he was at 21, and he was also at Windows in the World. And now he is located at 10 Columbus Circle with basically a steakhouse and related things. So you've changed, you've had to change your ideas of cooking each time you've been at a different restaurant.
Which has been one of the more exciting aspects, really, because that's one of the things that excites me about cooking is the ability to play different tunes.
And even when you were at Windows, you had a couple of different restaurants so that you could do different things. You had a little boutique-y restaurant.
We did. We had exactly, and also the bar and grill aspect, which now is very popular. So, and you know, I just for the record, I've been making burgers a long time since 21. You know,
by the way, all the recipes that have won and Michael's recipe are on our show page at wnyc.org. And we go now to Carly. Carly, you tied for first runner-up with your vegetarian enchiladas. Congratulations.
Yes, right. Thank you.
Good job, Carly.
So what did you like about Carly's version of the classic enchilada?
Well, I liked it when you get to the first line of the directions. It says, heat the oil in a wok. And I thought, this is it. Carly's got it. This is what a New York recipe is about. This is a recipe for vegetarian enchiladas, and it starts with the first direction is heat your oil in a wok.
And Carly, aren't you originally from Oregon? Now, is Mexican food popular in the Great Northwest?
Heating oil in a wok for Mexican food? I think so, maybe.
But really, seriously, the idea of using, you know, the utensil that you have, you know, cooking in a way that's quick and easy and fast. I liked the vegetarian aspect of this. Carly, you mentioned, using a local market or going to a local market where you could find particularly fresh vegetables that made you feel as at home as though you were on the West Coast. And then you incorporated some easier items for seasoning, like using some of a well-known roasted pepper vinaigrette. And, you know, that makes food accessible to people when you enable people and say it's okay to use someone else's vinaigrette to sort of finish this dish.
Has living in Kensington in Brooklyn changed your cooking from when you lived in Oregon?
Yes, definitely. One of the things is it's so diverse down here. If anyone's been here, you would know just from walking around. So I really try and challenge myself to use what's around. And there's also things that I'm familiar with that I can't find. So it's made me really flexible.
And another thing, you mentioned, Michael, some of the ingredients. We forgot to mention that Sweet potatoes are in this recipe. I've never seen an enchilada with a sweet potato in it.
No, but yeah. but they do exist, right? Right, Carly? You've seen them out on the West Coast?
Yes, sweet potatoes do exist. I think I might have been first introduced to this from, I had some friends back in Oregon that worked at a vegetarian restaurant, and I recall one night at a dinner party at someone's house, someone using sweet potatoes in an enchilada. So that was the first time I'd seen that.
And that kind of actually tied the enchilada almost to the Caribbean Latin food culture, which does use sweet potatoes or forms of sweet potatoes. So, and also the idea of there's lots of cheese in this and good flavorful cheese, and but there are lots of vegetables, and it seemed like once you learned how to make this dish that it would be a quick and easy dish, and it had so many kind of fun and easy adaptations that I thought it was the kind of recipe that suit a New York recipe profile.
And how did you come up with it?
It was completely improvised. So my mom and sister were actually visiting from Oregon. They were coming in on a red-eye flight a Friday morning. So that Thursday night, I got home from work, and I was like, oh, I gotta make some food for them. So I had a little bit of idea of what I wanted to make, and I went over to the local grocery store, the Golden Farm, and kind of picked out what I saw, what would look good, and just kind of threw it together.
Well, congratulations.
Good job.
And thank you so much for participating. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate talking with Michael Amonico and the winners of our Food in the City contest, recipe contest. All of the winning recipes, as I said before, can be found on our show page at WNYC.org. We go now to Megan, who is our official first runner-up. Hi, Megan.
Hi, how are you?
Tell us about your submission, Springtime in New York Quiche.
Yeah, so I had actually joined a community-sponsored farm for the first time this year, the Stone Ledge Farm. And so we're getting these deliveries of fresh vegetables every week, and I really wasn't sure what to do with them. So I decided to try to make a quiche, and it was fantastic. I mean, it was really delicious.
Including some ingredients you might not have ever cooked with before, like garlic scapes.
I had never used them before, and they're really amazing taste.
We're starting to see scapes
yeah.
a lot,
yeah.
and it's a wonder that they haven't been used before, because they're part of the garlic plant, and they were just thrown away in the past? Or did farmers cook them for themselves? Did you ever cook with scapes in the past?
Well, no. And I think I'm going to take a guess at this, but I think that the answer is we're seeing garlic scapes because we're seeing garlic farmers closer to home. And so, you know, you'd have, you know, at our local green markets or at the co-op that Megan belongs to, you know, it's part of the crop itself. So it's not just the dried garlic coming from California, but it's local garlic.
And you wind up giving us some choices, obviously, whatever came with the delivery, like it could be either Swiss or rainbow chard. I understand that you're from New Jersey, which is just across the river, but has the move to New York had an effect on your cooking?
Oh, definitely. When I was in New Jersey, you know, you go to the much larger suburban supermarkets, and here, you know, there's just so much more to choose from, and so many different small, you know, ethnic stores where there's just spices that I would have never stumbled across back in New Jersey.
That, you know, Megan, this is a really great recipe, I think, because it feels like an authentic country, you know, sort of farm-driven, natural, sort of local-driven quiche, which is a delicious dish, and it kind of got so overused in the generation past that you hardly ever see a great quiche.
But this uses very little liquid, only 3 tablespoons of milk, mostly relying on, I guess, eggs and a lot of cheese.
It's good cheesy.
Yeah, it makes it good.
And how did you come up with this combination, smoked Gouda, Comte, and Emmentaler?
I like the taste of smoked cheeses in the quiches. It gives it a little bit of a bite. And the other two cheeses were on special, so...
That's it.
There you go.
Yeah, it was pretty. It was pretty impromptu, but it was so delicious. We ended up making it about 3 weeks in a row.
But I particularly liked it because of it was a different choice of vegetables, which actually kind of adds some moistness to it in their own way. The chard and the escarole.
Just one more thing. What about the CSA? Can you talk a bit more about that? Because people who know about them love them, but quite a few of our listeners probably have no idea what they are.
Sure. It's a community-sponsored farm, and what they do, I belong to the Stone Ledge Farm, and every Monday we get a delivery at the Lenox Hill Center, which is a couple blocks from my house, and you go and you pick up whatever's fresh that week. And so yesterday I got some rat tail radishes that I'm going to figure out what to do with, and right now I've got a fridge full of cabbage I'm also not sure what to do with. I want to kind of brave it and make a sauerkraut, but it's a little scary because it's supposed to ferment for about 6 weeks.
But it helps the farmers because they know that they have a guaranteed sale, and they can also be more diverse in the crops that they come up with because people are going to try all the different things that they come in with.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason that I did it initially is I know it's good for the, you know, it's good environmentally and economically for the local farms, but I can't believe how much fun it is, you know, and how much we're really enjoying it and how delicious the produce is as well.
Carly, thank you so much for talking with us. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Megan, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
and now
Megan.
We go to our winner, Terry, who also listed Ann Cardos as being behind the recipe that she sent in, Hungarian stuffed peppers. Hi. How are you, Terry?
Hello, I'm fine, thank you.
Now, Michael, this would seem to me to be as traditional as you could get in terms of recipes. In fact, Terry herself asked why you chose this as the winner.
Well, non-traditional wasn't necessarily, the overriding way in which I chose recipes. This rose to the top because it had its roots in Hungarian cooking, which you don't see very much of in New York anymore. But that's another show. That's another story. But it had its roots, but yet it was adapted, and it was adapted to the New York market. It was a very well written recipe. It left a few questions for me, but when I kind of puzzled through this one and went through the cooking of it, I was better able to understand how you would get a successful dish result. And also, it lent itself to further improvisation in a way that I feel like taking this recipe and now putting my own spin on it. I love stuffed peppers, and stuffed vegetables are, I think, one of the great great culinary delights from all over the world.
But you're not using the traditional green peppers, are you?
Well, these are the peppers that I always knew that my mother used. I don't recall another kind. These are the thinner ones. They're narrower. That's how she always did it.
The Italian peppers.
Exactly. Italian Cubanel peppers. And that was one of the things that attracted me to this. I said, look, we got Hungarian stuffed peppers. We're not even using a bell pepper. We're using an Italian pepper. And it calls for Hungarian hot and sweet paprika. But then it calls for brown rice. And I thought, this reflects contemporary home cooking today in a way, and is the kind of recipe that you would very happily pass on to another family.
And where did you get this recipe from? Your mother?
This is from my mother, who emigrated with my father from Hungary in 1939. And unfortunately, both of them are gone now, so I do not have the opportunity to ask them if the Cubanel peppers were the same or close to the same type that she used in Hungary.
But this is not an unusual situation. People come here, they try to make something that they made back home, but they have to work with the ingredients that are available, and they come up with variations.
Yes. Somewhere, I believe, in things that I found after I went through my parents' house, I think there might be my mother's mother's cookbook somewhere, but it's in Hungarian, and unfortunately my parents did not bring me up speaking Hungarian. They wanted me to be a normal American kid. It was one mistake they made.
Well, that was I understand.
So I haven't had a chance to find someone to translate it for. Maybe it's in there. I don't know.
But I also love that it called for ground turkey. Mm-hmm. And now maybe I've had too much ground turkey on my mind. But I thought this is sort of something that happens a lot now, and people make that change, or they'll put turkey or chicken in place of beef or pork, and I'm not always in favor of that kind of swap, but in this case it made sense.
Do you make other Hungarian recipes?
Not too many, although we do have a family favorite for birthday and anniversary celebrations, and that is a flourless chocolate cake called a Zserbo cake. I believe there was a Zserbo cafe in Budapest years ago, and my husband jokes that he married me because of my mother's baking, but sometimes we do a chestnut cake with chestnut puree. A lot of the Hungarian things have a lot of sour cream in them, and there's a lot of pork, and I'm trying to eat healthy, so I don't cook a lot of Hungarian things, but some.
I understand that cake your mother made for your wedding.
my poor mother. Well, that was what we really wanted, so she baked for quite a long time and making different sizes so it could have tiers, and it not only looked lovely, but it was probably the best tasting wedding cake I've ever tasted anyway.
Michael, you'll be making this recipe at Porterhouse New York tomorrow, and Terry, you'll be there?
Oh, definitely. I'm looking forward to it.
And yeah. We'll be videotaping it.
Yeah, I look forward to meeting you, Terry.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
I'm just astonished that this was chosen in light of all the other wonderful recipes, but I think it's a nice memorial to my mother.
Thank you, and I'm sure that listeners who check out the recipes will understand why the recipes that you chose, Michael, you did choose. Just one more thing, because I was thinking about this. In your case, growing up in an Italian-American family, did your parents also talk about having to adjust to do things to make... Or was it your grandparents?
No, my father was an immigrant, and my mother grew up in an immigrant household and actually didn't – she was born here but didn't learn to speak English until she was 5. Yeah, I mean, they did – they talked about adjusting to having more food than they ever had in Sicily. You know, it was tough times in the – my father but the adaptation, you know, we see in Italian-American restaurants, you know, what people call red sauce restaurants and that kind of thing, you know, and that we see at home. But my mother always stayed very true to a number of Sicilian recipes that she, you know, cooked with her mother. And so there was a strong sense of that history growing up, but they adapted to the market.
Well, Lydia Bastanich, who has a very authentic restaurant called Felidia, has put out a cookbook of Italian-American cooking, because when she came here, she was forced to do that when she got a restaurant job. And she's come to love it as a separate kind of cuisine.
It is a separate cuisine. I mean, certainly many people will tell you when they go to Italy that they can't find the things that they've eaten here and thought was authentic Italian cooking. But certainly, you know, even in my home, there were Italian-American dishes right alongside very traditional. And I'll just give you one great recipe. I grew up eating belly of tuna, which, you know, is the most prized of tuna that we would find in a sushi restaurant. But in the Sicilian manner, that belly of tuna is braised with onions and capers and a little bit of sugar with the onions and capers. And that was a Friday dish. But, of course, it was great in the marketplace because it was very affordable, and my mother couldn't understand why everyone wasn't buying it.
And now, of course, it's not affordable.
No, it's impossible.
Michael Amatico is the executive chef and partner at Porterhouse New York and the Time Warner Building at 10 Columbus Circle. Thank you so much, Michael, and I'll be looking forward to that video that you're going to be doing with Terry.
Thank you, Leonard.